If this is the truth of works, the first thing the sadhaka has to do is to recoil from the egoistic forms of activity and get rid of the sense of an I that acts. Of course, this will be the point of his next chapter, Equality and the Annihilation of the Ego. But this refers, of course, to the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, around shloka 47. This is the preliminary step. He has to see and feel that everything happens in him by the plastic conscious or subconscious, or sometimes superconscious, automatism of his mental and bodily instruments, moved by the forces of spiritual, mental, vital, and physical nature. So even if there is a higher will acting upon the nature, it is still the constructed personality, the being of Prakriti form, or I should say the becoming, the shape that the spiritual force would work through, but normally it would be the mental, the vital, the physical. There is a personality on his surface that chooses and wills, submits and struggles, tries to make good in nature or prevail over nature, but this personality is itself a construction of nature and so dominated, driven, determined by her that it cannot be free. It is a formation or expression of the self in her. It is a self of nature rather than a self of self. His natural and processive, not his spiritual and permanent being. A temporary constructed personality, not the true immortal person. This would be Bhagavad Gita, chapter 3, verses 28 through 30. So I cite these just to show you, you know, how firmly Sri Aurobindo is placed in his understanding of the Gita, of the Upanishads, of the Veda as well. That hardly, when he writes a sentence, it's not something that has been it has been fully endued by his experience in the practice of the yoga of the Gita, dating all the way back to his period in the Alipur jail. He knew it so thoroughly that it was just part of his being. It is that person that he must become. This essential self, this Atman. He must succeed in being inwardly quiescent, detach himself as the observer from the outer active personality, and learn the play of the cosmic forces in him by standing back from all blinding absorption in its turns and movements. Thus calm, detached, a student of himself and a witness of his nature, he realizes that he is the individual soul who observes the works of nature, accepts tranquilly her results, and sanctions or withholds his sanction from the impulse to her acts. This is that same section of verses as before. So, again, the very meaningful connotation that as we stand closer and closer to the soul, our will reflects more and more the spiritual possibility, and we are less and less governed by the mechanics, by the determinism of Prakriti. A new energy and force enter into the picture. If that were not so, there would be no hope. At present, This soul, or Purusha, is little more than an acquiescent spectator, influencing perhaps the action and development of the being by the pressure of its veiled consciousness, but for the most part, delegating its powers or a fragment of them to the outer personality, in fact, to nature. For this outer self is not Lord, but subject to her, Anisha. But once unveiled, it can make its sanction or refusal effective, become the master of the action, dictate sovereignly a change of nature. So normally the true self is not something we are truly in touch with. It stands at the back of the nature, supporting all. When we begin to search for it, it's a sign that it sees that there is an opportunity, an aperture in the constructed being of Prakriti to make its way to the front. And we begin to feel an aspiration for something beyond. But ordinarily, the personality that we are is governed by Prakriti, constructed by Prakriti. There is no will. As we said last time, we are not so much thinking but thought. We are not so much living as lived. What can impose itself eventually is the awakened power of the Purusha, who comes into the nature and suffuses that nature with its power. So for Sri Aurobindo again, Purusha and Prakriti is an effective division by which we gain freedom from thraldom to our natural selves, but ultimately they must be deeply connected for there to be interface possible between them. And it's only if there is an interface that Purusha can impinge upon Prakriti and enforce upon her a change. Even if for a long time, as the result of fixed association and past storage of energy, the habitual movement takes place independent of the Purusha's assent, and even if the sanctioned movement is persistently refused by nature for want of past habit, still, he will discover that in the end, his assent or refusal prevails. Slowly, with much resistance, or quickly, with a rapid accommodation of her means and tendencies, she modifies herself and her workings in the direction indicated by his inner sight or volition. So, Purusha ultimately compels Prakriti. Thus, he learns in place of mental control or egoistic will, an inner spiritual control which makes him master of the nature forces that work in him and not their unconscious instrument or mechanic slave. Above and around him is the Shakti, the universal mother, and from her he can get all his inmost soul needs and wills. If only he has a true knowledge of her ways and a true surrender to the divine will in her. This reminds you of the passages in the Gita where Krishna is telling Arjuna, few come to understand me in all the ways of my beings and all the tattvas. So coming to know the inner machinery of nature, what is the world behind the world, and understand those forces, etc., is part of the mastery that the spiritual being wishes to attain in life. Finally, he becomes aware of that highest dynamic self within him and within nature, which is the source of all his seeing and knowing, the source of the sanction, the source of the acceptance, the source of the rejection. This is Bhagavad Gita in the sixth chapter, verses 24 and 25. This is the Lord, the Supreme, the one and all, Ishvara Shakti, of whom his soul is a portion, a being of that being, a power of that power. So, if the Lord is the bedrock of existence, a being of that being, Sat, and a power of that power, that would be the Chit Tapas, the Shakti. The rest of our progress depends on our knowledge of the ways in which the Lord of Works manifests his will in the world and in us and executes them through the transcendent and universal Shakti. This is a hint carrying us back to his book, The Mother. The Lord sees in his omniscience the thing that has to be done. This seeing is his will, because sight and will are the same. Knowledge and will are the same at the level of that creative transcendence above the cosmos in which we operate. This seeing is his will. It is a form of creative power, and that which he sees, the all-conscious mother, one with him, takes into her dynamic self and embodies, and executive nature force carries it out as the mechanism of their omnipotent omniscience. So this is a direct reference to the transcendence, where Ishvara and Shakti are one, that the self of the Supreme stands and acts in the power of the Shakti. And this is a typical demonstration in prose of what is the relationship between Shiva and Shakti in the old tantric theses. Go back to that note that ended the last section about Ishvara Shakti, which refers back to in the Gita, pardon me, in the Life Divine, the chapter on Brahman, Purusha, Ishvara, and forward to the final pages of the Life Divine, you get a great picture of what it is when that will of the Supreme pours itself out into active form in life. But this vision of what is to be, and therefore of what is to be done, arises out of the very being, pours directly out of the consciousness and delight of existence of the Lord, spontaneously, like light from the sun. This is Satchit Ananda in distributed force. This is the supramental consciousness. So, where we see Ishvara and Shakti in perfect balance, in the dynamic expression, multiply of what oneness is, it is in that supramental poise. It is not our mortal attempt to see, our difficult arrival at truth of action and motive or just demand of nature. When the individual soul is entirely at one in its being and knowledge with the Lord and directly in touch with the original Shakti, the transcendent mother, the supreme will can then arise in us too in the high divine manner as a thing that must be and is achieved by the spontaneous action of nature. There is then no desire, no responsibility, no reaction. All takes place in the peace, calm, light, power of the supporting and enveloping and inhabiting divine. So this is described by the Gita in the final chapter, 18 verses, shlokas 54 through 58. And this very much Sri Aurobindo was bringing into his own person in the years from 1932 forward, as he could feel more and more the descent of the transcendent as it approached and expressed itself through him. There was that perfect balance of the transcendent, universalized, expressing itself through his individuality. No ego left to stand in between, to detour, deflect, or mar the perfection of the action. Simply the transcendent acted through him. But even before that highest approach to identity is achieved, something of the supreme will can manifest in us as an imperative impulsion, a God-driven action. We then act by a spontaneous self-determining force, but a fuller knowledge of meaning and aim arises only afterwards. Or the impulse to action may come as an inspiration or intuition, but rather in the heart and body than in the mind. Here, an effective sight enters in, but the complete and exact knowledge is still deferred and comes, if at all, later. But the divine will may descend too, as a luminous single command, or a total perception, or a continuous current of perception of what is to be done into the will or into the thought, or as a direction from above, spontaneously fulfilled by the lower members. And of course, you know that Sri Aurobindo was in perfect receptivity to the Adesh, the command, the fiat, that would visit him and drive him from Calcutta to Chandranagar, from there to Pondicherry, and at every moment of his sadhana, always attuned to that, and coercing, shaping, fashioning his members to be vibrantly in unison with that. When it came, he wanted his body, he wanted his life energies, he wanted his mind to work harmoniously with that will as it sought to execute itself through him. So what he writes here, again, is based on his own personal experience. This is why we call it Sri Aurobindo's yoga, isn't it? When the yoga is imperfect, only some actions can be done in this way, or else a general action may so proceed, but only during periods of exaltation and illumination. And this, we have to note, was progressively true in his own case. He expressed his the reluctance of some parts of his nature to this Adesh when he spoke at Uttarpara after being released from prison, very candidly. And of course, he notes throughout his life, when referring to his own case, that he had to face storm and struggle and darkness and long periods in which there was no seeming progress at all. 6 months at a time where he didn't move an inch, and then suddenly a movement forward again. But even though the faith might be challenged, it was not shaken. When the yoga is perfect, all action becomes of this character. So, capable of immediate receptivity, of a high action, of an installation into the circumstances, we may indeed distinguish three stages of a growing progress by which, first, the personal will is occasionally or frequently enlightened or moved by a supreme will or conscious force behind it, then constantly replaced, and last, identified and merged in that divine power action. The first is the stage when we are still governed by the intellect, heart, and senses. These have to seek or wait for the divine inspiration and guidance and do not always find or receive it. The second is the stage when the human intelligence is more and more replaced by a high illumined or intuitive spiritualized mind, the external human heart by the inner psychic heart, the senses by purified and selfless vital force. The third is the stage when we rise even above spiritualized mind to the supramental levels. And these stages are, in a sense, touched upon or outlined anyway in chapter 5 of his book, The Mother. In all three stages, the fundamental character of the liberated action is the same. A spontaneous working of Prakriti no longer through or for the ego, but at the will and for the enjoyment of the Supreme Purusha. At a higher level, this becomes the truth of the Absolute and Universal Supreme, expressed through the individual soul and worked out consciously through the nature, no longer through a half-perception and a diminished or distorted effectuation by the stumbling, ignorant, and all-deforming energy of lower nature in us, but by the all-wise, transcendent, and universal Mother. This is the elegant harmony in which the individual, expressive of the cosmic power, installs in nature the will of the transcendent. The Lord has veiled himself and his absolute wisdom and eternal consciousness in ignorant nature force and suffers her to drive the individual being with its complicity as the ego. So this is the mission that has been imparted to Prakriti, not Paraprakriti, but Prakriti. This lower action of nature continues to prevail, often even in spite of man's half-lit imperfect efforts at a nobler motive and a purer self-knowledge. Our human effort at perfection fails or progresses very incompletely, owing to the force of nature's past actions in us, her past formations, her long-rooted associations. It turns towards a true and high-climbing success only when a greater knowledge and power than our own breaks through the lid of our ignorance and guides or takes up our personal will. This harkens us back to the Rig Veda. This takes us back to the Isha Upanishad, this reference to that lid of the ignorance breaking and allowing that light to cascade in. For our human will is a misled and wandering ray that has parted from the supreme puissance. The period of slow emergence out of this lower working into a higher light and purer force is the valley of the shadow of death for the striver after perfection. It is a dreadful passage, full of trials, sufferings, sorrows, obscurations, stumblings, errors, pitfalls. And of course, this describes the difficult, torturous passage in the yoga that he and the mother faced from the early 30s, up until the point when he's writing this, probably in the early 40s, where they continued to progress even though they faced all the outrageous obscurations and refusals within the core of nature's own being, but also in those who lived and worked around them. They had to resolve all the disharmonies present in nature, in the community, at the same time that they worked on nature as she hid the possibilities in the inconscient from their light, extending further and further their work. They thought they might be able to achieve all of it in a few years, but as he wrote about the inconscient, it has a way of pulling itself down deeper and deeper into the coils of a hidden darkness. And hence, the trials, the sufferings, the sorrows. To abridge and alleviate this ordeal, or to penetrate it with the divine delight, faith is necessary. An increasing surrender of the mind to the knowledge that imposes itself from within, and above all, a true aspiration and a right and unfaltering and sincere practice. This goes back to his book, The Mother, chapters 2 and 3. Practice unfalteringly, says the Gita, with a heart free from despondency, the yoga. Chapter 6, verse 23. For even though in the earlier stage of the path, we drink deep of the bitter poison of internal discord and suffering, the last taste of this cup is the sweetness of the nectar of immortality and the honey wine of an eternal ananda. So we complete the chapter. Sri Aurobindo noted about his own practice, if he did not have that experience of ananda, then from the outset, this this yoga, which aims at the perfection of nature, the affirmation of life, might not have been tolerable. So next week, equality and the annihilation of ego. But let's close with some lines from Savitri, which are in the back of the poem. This goes to Book 11, the Book of Everlasting Day. The Soul's Choice and the Supreme Consummation. We begin somewhere on page 707. Then in the process of evolving time, all shall be drawn into a single plan. A divine harmony shall be Earth's law. Beauty and joy remold her way to live. Even the body shall remember God. Nature shall draw back from mortality, and spirit's fire shall guide the earth's blind force. Knowledge shall bring into the aspirant thought a high proximity to truth and God. The supermind shall claim the world for light, and thrill with love of God the enamored heart, and place light's crown on nature's lifted head, and found light's reign on her unshaking base. A greater truth than earth's shall roof in earth, and shed its sunlight on the roads of mind. A power infallible shall lead the thought, a seeing puissance govern life and act, in earthly hearts kindle the immortal's fire. A soul shall wake in the inconscient's house. The mind shall be God-vision's tabernacle, the body intuition's instrument, and life a channel for God's visible power. All earth shall be the spirit's manifest home, hidden no more by the body and the life, hidden no more by the mind's ignorance. An unerring hand shall shape event and act. The spirit's eyes shall look through nature's eyes. The spirit's force shall occupy nature's force. This world shall be God's visible garden house. The earth shall be a field and camp of God. Man shall forget consent to mortality and his embodied frail impermanence. This universe shall unseal its occult sense. Creation's process change its antique front. An ignorant evolution's hierarchy release the wisdom chained below its base. The spirit shall be the master of his world, lurking no more in form's obscurity, and nature shall reverse her action's rule. The outward world disclose the truth it veils. All things shall manifest the covert God. All shall reveal the spirit's light and might and move to its destiny of felicity. Even should a hostile force cling to its reign and claim its rights, perpetual sovereignty, and man refuse his high spiritual fate, yet shall the secret truth in things prevail. For in the march of all fulfilling time, the hour must come of the transcendent's will. All turns and winds towards his predestined ends in nature's fixed, inevitable course, decreed since the beginning of the worlds in the deep essence of created things. Even there shall come as a high crown of all the end of death, the death of ignorance. But first, high truth must set her feet on earth, and man aspire to the eternal's light, and all his members feel the spirit's touch, and all his life obey an inner force. Namaste. Jai Ma.